This is Night Call. Broadcast live with host Russ Gibb. You participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. And now, here's Night Call host, Russ Gibb.
Hello, night people. This is Gibb. Standing by at his home in Pound Ridge, New York, is Mr. David Reed, roving editor for the Reader's Digest and author of a new book on the Congo entitled 111 Days in Stanleyville. Mr. Reed has spent several years in Africa and was in the Congo in 1964 during the rebellion. Now, if you'd like to ask David a question on the Congo or make a comment, give us a call here at Night Call. Now, it's very easy to call us here. Our Night Call number is area code 313-846-6601. Now, remember, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make that call station to station. Our Night Call number, area code 313-846-6601. Our operators are on duty, and we invite you to join us here on Night Call. Area code 313-846-6601. Our guest tonight, Mr. David Reed, author of 111 Days in Stanleyville. Our topic, the Congo. Mr. Reed, what's the historical background of the Congo?
Well, Russ, the Congo was a Belgian colony for more than half a century. It got its independence in 1960, and it was rather thoroughly ill-prepared for it. Within a few days after getting independence, it exploded into anarchy, and as you remember, the United Nations sent troops in there for 4 years, but when they were withdrawn in the summer of 1964, the Congo was still in just as tumultuous a state as it had been 4 years earlier. And it was just a few months after the withdrawal of the UN troops that the events that are portrayed in my book began. That is to say, the rebel conquest of Stanleyville, and with it the capture of 1,600 foreign hostages, 1,200 of them Europeans and the 400 others Asians.
David, did the church play any role in the Congo, historically and during the rebellion?
Yes, all along the Christian missionaries have had a role in the Congo. They, for example, were primarily responsible for education there, particularly in the earlier years, as there had been very few government churches at that time. And it was they really who laid the foundations for education there. During the rebellion itself, the rebels, who incidentally called themselves Simbas, that's the Swahili word for lions, at times they were rather pro-European, at times were anti-European, and the missionaries sort of suffered according to the mood, you know.
Well, I remember reading in your book about right immediately after the rebellion broke out and the Simbas had taken over Stanleyville, that Bible sales soared, that the Simbas were actually buying Bibles.
Yes, they weren't sure, Russ, the missionaries weren't sure what purpose the Simbas had intended for the Bibles, whether they were to be used for conventional purposes, shall we say, or maybe they regarded them as powerful fetishes. But in any case, some of these missionary people were pleased, as they'd been trying for years to get Bibles in the hands of the ordinary Congolese, and usually without any luck.
But I'm not sure that, as it turned out, that they were using the Bibles for the purposes that the missionaries may have wished. Is that correct?
Well, at least some of them weren't, you know.
We're talking tonight with Mr. David Reed. He's editor for the Reader's Digest and author of a new book on the Congo called 111 Days in Stanleyville. We're talking again about the Congo. Right now, we're wondering about the church. David, did you say that the missionaries did a good job of educating the Congolese, or that they did a poor job?
Well, as I personally would regard as a sort of a mixed bag of things. Some of them did a good job, and some did not a very good job.
Well, in what areas did they do a job that...
Well, it depended, Russ, more on the individual missionary. Some of them were very good, and there were some of them well prepared for what they were going to do out there, and some of them were very badly prepared. It's unfortunate, but you get all sorts of people in a situation like that. Some of the missionaries, for example, had virtually no schooling or education themselves, coming from fundamentalist groups and sometimes very tiny little groups, and they would get sent out to Africa and turned loose, and they weren't very well prepared to do anything, really.
What things would they do that would cause problems with the Africans?
One of the things, and this is a problem all over Africa, is that you've got you've got dozens of different denominations and sects all competing with each other for the allegiance of the African, and all of them eager to convert the African to his particular brand of Christianity. Well, to an African who is interested in making such a move, it naturally is quite bewildering to have all these different denominations competing, and each one saying that it has got the truth, and only it has got the truth, particularly to simple and unsophisticated people, and, well, even to sophisticated people. This is rather bewildering and quite patently contradictory.
Did they ever cause overt problems in the Congo, the missionaries? I mean, did they ever violate any of the rules of the Congolese that caused problems?
Well, only in the sense that you had a lot of sectarianism, and particularly between Catholics and Protestants, but also among various Protestant groups at the same time, which certainly didn't do the overall cause of evangelism any good.
During the actual rebellion, were many missionaries killed?
Yes, there were. I don't have the figures right at my fingertips, Russ, but I would say perhaps, including the Catholic missionaries, half of the 300 or 400 whites who were killed at one time or other during the rebellion, very few of those in Stanleyville, incidentally, I would say at least half of those were missionaries, and most of them Catholic missionaries.
Well, now, why? If these men had been doing what we would hope would be good work with these people, why would they kill them?
Well, most of them were doing good work, and some of the ones that weren't, at least for trying, you know. The thing was that once this Simba revolution got going really strongly, they turned against all whites and no longer made any difference between who the particular white was. If you happened to have white skin, that was quite enough. And they were picked up as hostages and held. And then as the fortunes of the Simba regime in Stanleyville continued to wane, they looked around for scapegoats to have and used the missionaries and other foreigners for this purpose, and had executions and so on.
Well, now, the Simbas we're talking about, that's S-I-M, right?
Right.
These people, where did they come from? I mean, were they actually in Stanleyville before the revolution and just sort of came up, or the rebellion, I should say? Or?
Well, they came from a region south of Stanleyville, two provinces, one of them Maniema and the other Sankuro province. Biggest town of any consequence in their area was Kindu, K-I-N-D-U. And early in June of last year, they raised the sort of thing you might call a beggar's army of malcontented tribesmen, and witch doctors promised them immunity, for example, to bullets if they went through a certain witchcraft mumbo-jumbo. They would have dawa, which is the Swahili word for magic, and then if anyone shot at them, the bullet would simply turn to water. And they set out with this great ragtag army and swept north, and almost without any opposition from the government troops, who incidentally believe that these fellows really did have dawa, that they took Stanleyville.
Now, this was magic that these Simbas had. Couldn't this magic be gotten for the government officials or the government troops?
I suppose so, but it's sort of the essence of a situation like this. You keep one step ahead of the enemy, you know. And, I don't really know. I suppose the Simba witch doctors would say only they could dispense such powerful stuff.
Well, now, how did the Congolese in Stanleyville look upon the Simbas? Did they fear them also? Did they laugh at them as sort of bushmen?
Well, some of them were attracted to them. You see, the central government of the Congo has never been very popular with its own people.
Why is that?
Well, historically, it never has. There's no sense of nationhood in the Congo, and they tend to regard any government, Leopoldville, as a bunch of foreigners who rob them of taxes once a year and otherwise mistreat them. And this is just the sort of the permanent frame of mind. And there was pretty good reason at the time, and perhaps still is, for people living out in the outlying provinces to be a bit unhappy with the central government, as it has been hopelessly corrupt and incompetent, and not the sort of government would inspire a lot of enthusiasm among anybody.
In other words, under the Belgians, the Congo and the government in Stanleyville was crooked, correct?
No, I'm talking about colonial times.
Colonial times.
Post-colonial times, independence, Russ.
I see.
Corruption as such was never a terrible problem during colonial times. You didn't have a great deal of it. What you did have was pretty well squelched. I mean, colonialism had its faults, but corruption was not one of the major ones.
Okay, after independence, who was actually in control of the government? Were Congolese in control, or were they just puppets of the
No, they were fully in control. Of course, they got a lot of foreign assistance and advice, including a four-year intervention by troops under the United Nations command, but for the most part, it was their show, really.
And the Congolese themselves, the citizens, they felt that the government, even of the black man, was corrupt. Is that basically what we're saying here?
You're right. Mm-hmm.
So this was a case of black man being pitted against black man.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, the whites somehow became the middleman in this thing.
Yeah, they were sort of caught in the middle. They weren't primary participants in the political processes. They were only bystanders in that sense. They still were extremely influential in the running the economy, and they still provided the technical expertise and so on, but the technical experts. But no, that politically they were pretty well neutralized by that time.
Well, when the revolution broke out, or the rebellion, I should refer to it as, who was the president of the Congo? Shambi?
No, this is just prior to Shambi. Sorry.
I'm trying to think. It's not Kasavubu.
101 things to think about it. Wait a second. Ask me another question first.
Okay. I'm wondering, that wasn't Genye. Maybe one of our callers would know who was the president at that time.
I've got it right in my tongue.
You have it in your book here, and I'm trying to look at the book here and see if I can find it. Some of the calls are coming in.
It's one of the things you...
Well, I think what we'll do is we'll look for it while we take our station break. Okay, David?
It's me.
Our guest tonight is Mr. David Reed. He's the author of a rather interesting book on the Congo called 111 Days in Stanleyville.
We're talking tonight about the Congo and about the church's role in the Congo. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Five gold rings, four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree.
She's downright greedy.
Who is?
The girl in that song. 12 gifts, and what gifts?
Well, people like different things.
I'll say, five golden rings, four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. That I like, a partridge in a pear tree.
Oh, it's just a Christmas carol about gifts. Bit different, perhaps.
Well, certainly that, all right. Six swans are swimming, really.
And what about your gifts?
Well, I'm not giving anything like that. Besides, I think there's getting to be too much gift-giving.
Oh, I don't know. Christmas began as a gift.
You mean the baby in the manger? That's different.
No, it's not. We needed that gift to show he loves us and cares enough to share our life here. And our giving shows that we care.
With a partridge in a pear tree.
Oh, for goodness sake, that's just a song. but it does have the right idea about Christmas being a time for giving.
I suppose now you're going to sing all the rest of the 12 verses.
Yes, I am. On the sixth day of Christmas, my dear.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb. Hello again, Night People, and we're talking tonight to Mr. David Reed, author of 111 Days in Stanleyville, a book on the Congo, and that's our topic on Night Call, the Congo, and particularly the Simba Revolution in the Congo. If you'd like to join us here, it's very easy to do. All you have to do is call area code 313-846-6601. Now remember, you may dial us direct. And if you wish, you may make that call collect. You may reverse the charges. Our night call number, area code 313-846-6601. Our lines are open, and we invite you to join us here on Night Call. If you get a busy signal, please do not become discouraged. Just hang up that old telephone and dial us back again. Area code 313-846-6601. Mr. Reed, during the break, did you have a chance to find out the name of that guy that was the president at the outset?
On the tip of my mind all the time, Cyril Adula.
Adula? Mm-hmm. Well, where was he? I mean, why didn't he intercede?
He was, on behalf of the hostages?
Yes, right.
He was sort of shuffled out of power in a political upheaval in Leopoldville, which is the capital of the Congo. A little, just before that, really. And he never had much to do with the whole thing.
David, we have a caller standing by in Denver, Colorado, a listener on KTLN, Mr. Tom Stevens. Good evening, Mr. Stevens. Speak right up. You're on Night Call. Your comment, sir. Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask David a question, if you don't mind.
Yes, sir.
The missionaries who come to the Congo to do missionary work, I know they are sponsored by different denominations throughout the world. And these denominations have a great expense to get the missionaries to the Congo. Do these missionaries work together in order to try to save expense from the different denominations?
The question is, do the missionaries work together?
Yes, from the different denominations.
It happens, I suppose, at times. It's certainly not the pattern there.
The reason I was curious, I know there is a great expense to operating missionary fields throughout the Congo. I thought possibly they might work together to try to conserve some of the expense.
I suppose some of them do, but it's not particularly the pattern there.
Right. Another question I'm curious. The missionaries who come, especially during a flare that they're having in the Congo, are they afraid for their lives?
Well, I suppose nowadays you find a lot of them who are, very definitely. And of course, for good reason. In the past, that they hadn't been particularly, prior to independence, they hadn't been, because there was a good deal of personal security in the Congo, but ever since 1960, it's been quite the opposite. And there have been a number of missionaries killed even prior to this Simba uprising.
Right. The people in the Congo living there now, are they very religious-minded, or are we bringing this to them now?
Well, by that, do you mean Christian-minded?
Yes.
Well, it's a small minority of them who are Christians. Probably the great bulk of them are animists, that is to say, followers of traditional native religions that you could call, I suppose, pagan religions. And some of them also are Muslims. But there has been a hard core, as it were, of native Christians all along, but they are no means the majority.
David, can I ask a question here?
Sure.
Do you feel that the missionaries, or that Christianity, rather, that the natives look upon Christianity as part of colonialism and new imperialism, as it were?
Oh, there's no question that some of them do, yes.
What about the average guy? Is he even concerned about it? The average Congolese?
Well, it's hard to say what the average, you know, if there is an average guy, because Congo's an enormous place. You've got a couple hundred different tribes there, most of whom can't even speak a language that's comprehensible to the next man.
Tom?
Yes?
Do you think that it makes sense that the Christians and the missionaries have been in the Congo for, what, over about 100 years? And yet these people turn on them. Now, why do you think that they would turn on the missionaries?
Oh, my estimation is a great number of reasons. I would say, one, that they're not educated to either the way we believe. I don't think they have something to look forward to the people who do believe in true Christianity. I don't really know. I'm not there. I would have to be there to give a correct answer.
Tom, I want to thank you for expressing your opinions on Night Call. Yes, sir. Good night.
Good night.
Mr. Tom Stevens, a gentleman from Denver, Colorado, listening on KTLN. And let's go out now to Baltimore, Maryland. A gentleman who is listening on WBAL, Mr. Robert Shapiro. Good evening, Robert. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, sir.
Oh, all right. Thank you. I want to ask a question that I'm sure is on the minds of numerous people. What might perhaps be called the civilized world, and that is, are the people of the Congo, as say its so-called alleged leaders, reasonably responsible people who can go ahead and form a cohesive government whereby they are able to, well, govern themselves? And I'm not referring to it according to our American standards.
But any type of government?
Well, I'm not thinking now necessarily of it, you know, is it?
Not as sophisticated as ours.
Pardon me?
In other words, you're saying not as sophisticated as our type of government.
Well, no, I wasn't anyway suggesting that.
David, what do you think?
Sorry, I couldn't hear the question too well, Russ.
Bob wanted to know whether or not the Congolese are capable of forming a sophisticated, or I shouldn't use that word, a government to govern themselves. Are they responsible enough, the present leaders of the Congo?
Well, I think the key word in the answer is sophisticated. Obviously, they're incapable of forming a sophisticated government. Now, they have managed to limp along with a lot of foreign assistance and UN military intervention and so on for 5 years. But there have hardly been five exemplary years from the point of view of an effective sort of government that provides social services for its people and that sort of thing.
Bob?
They can limp along, or certainly, and with a pretense of it, with heavy foreign aid, but obviously they're not capable of running the show themselves and with any degree of efficiency.
Bob?
Yes.
May I ask you a question?
Surely.
What do you think is going to happen in the Congo, then, if there are not leaders?
I think that what I think must be quite obvious.
Well, I wonder if you could say it.
Pardon me?
What do you really think is going to happen?
Well, I am not a soothsayer by any means, and but however the, well, uprising or the demonstration, the violent and bloody one that occurred, oh, perhaps 2, possibly 3 years ago,
Can you speak up a little bit, Bob, please?
Yes, I'm trying to. How's that?
Better, thank you, sir.
Oh, okay. I said I was referring primarily to the action or the totally irresponsible and bloody action of the Congolese with regard to the various religious missions in that area. About, say, possibly 2 to 3 years ago. I mean, it was an action, I think, that, you know, shocked the world.
Well, Bob, do you think that people have the right, and I'll ask this to David also, gentlemen, do you think that people have the right, if they want self-government, to also make the mistakes of learning to govern themselves? In other words, should we give them the opportunity to make mistakes, even if a bloodshed does occur?
This to me is resorting to savagery of the most medieval nature. And business in the United States felt too damn wrong. And my views are rather twisted, but I don't think that they are, for the most part.
Dave?
Well, first of all, the egg cannot be unscrambled now. Nothing's going to restore colonialism in the Congo. It's dead and gone. The difficulty that exists in the Congo is built in historically, and it rises from the fact that although the Belgians did a good job of developing the country economically, it was a political disaster. They never trained the Congolese in self-government, and they never allowed any of them to receive university education, acting on the premise that a little learning is a dangerous thing. And as a result, when independence came, they had a population then around 12, 13 million. There were less than 30 university graduates at the time.
In the whole country?
In the whole country. And no one had a bit of experience in government or parliamentary procedures or anything else, modern administration. The thing was, just could not succeed. The Belgians had never intended to give independence to Congo for a long, long time, if ever. They had never entered their official planning, and when things got a bit rough and there were a few riots in Leopoldville, they simply abdicated their responsibilities and marched out. Perhaps some of the more ultras among them thought, foolishly or naively, that they would be invited back to restore order if the Congolese had made a mess out of it. Well, that was just completely unrealistic thinking that nobody's going to invite back a colonial power, no matter how great the turmoil may be.
So here comes that word responsible again in. Could it be that the white man really wasn't responsible in the Congo also, as well as maybe the colored man?
Well, certainly. Obviously, the Belgians made a mess of it in the sense of not educating these people for self-government, and then trusting self-government at them, which they were thoroughly ill-prepared for. And secondly, the whole history of the Congo has been one going way back of a rather brutal exploitation of the blacks by the whites. Before it became a Belgian colony, at the turn of the century, it was called the Congo Free State, and it was governed as the personal domain of King Leopold. And there was an international protest over the fact that natives were obliged to gather rubber, wild rubber, for their colonial masters, and those who didn't, one of the punishments was to cut their hands off.
Yes, he was a brutal leader.
One of the things that I quoted in this book of mine was a stanza from Vachel Lindsay's poem, The Congo, which goes, "Listen to the yell of Leopold's ghost burning in hell for his hand-named host." That's what Lindsay had in mind, was the atrocities that went on there committed by whites against the natives.
Bob, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Yes, sir. It is I. Thank you.
Good night, sir. Mr. Robert Shapiro, a gentleman from Baltimore, Maryland, listening on WBAL. Our guest tonight
is Mr. David Reed, and he's author of 111 Days in Stanleyville, a new book on the Congo. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Now that's a pretty happy thought.
Fa-la-la-la-la.
Yes, and do you mind if I finish my song now?
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Tis the season to be done.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Hello again, gentle people, and we're talking about the Congo tonight, and we're discussing a new book called 111 Days in Stanleyville, published by Harper & Row Publishers out of New York. And the guest tonight on Night Call is Mr. David Reed. He's the author of the book. And if you'd like to express your opinion on the Congo or ask Mr. Reed a question about the Congo, and particularly about the Zimbas, which were the leading force, I understand, in the rebellion in 1964, give us a buzz here at Night Call. Now, it's very easy to call us. Just dial area code 313-846-6601. Now, remember, you may call from anywhere, collect. You may reverse the charges. If you would you please make that call station to station? Now, our Night Call number, area code 313-846-6601. Our Night Call lines are open, and we invite you to join us here on Night Call. David, I have a caller standing by in Denver, Colorado, a listener on KTLN, Mr. Bernie Donovic. Good evening, Bernie. Speak right up, sir. You're on Night Call. Yes, sir.
Mr. Reed, a few questions.
Go right ahead, Bernie, please.
Could you tell me, please, to what extent the United States is involved in giving aid to African nations? Are you familiar with that?
Yes. In a general way, we give aid to a great many of the independent countries in tropical Africa. Among them, we've been giving lots and lots of aid to the Congo. And the United States pretty well financed the four-year UN military intervention in the Congo, paid about half the bills, what's something like a $250 million.
David,
the notes are kind of jumbled up here, so if you don't mind, I'll just go on. They're a little hodgepodge.
Go right ahead, Bernie.
Have a population explosion in Africa, or what we call a population explosion?
Yes, sir, they do.
Is anything being done about this birth control, or is it left up to the people themselves?
Very little is really being done about it at this time. People themselves look on birth control, they're aghast at the idea. They regard a man in Africa generally regards a very large family as a status symbol, really.
If he can afford it, isn't that it?
Well, people living in poverty anyway, and people, moreover, who live on the land, they can always afford one more. It isn't going to make that much difference. I mean, they've got darn little to begin with, and it's just a question of having just a slight bit less for each mouth that comes along.
Well, if they're getting aid from another country, then possibly they don't feel that it's necessary to worry about taking care of their own. But with a population explosion, do you look for, or do you think there might be in the offing, a worldwide uprising or revolt on the part of the black people?
No, they're not. One point I wanted to add is... particularly in connection with our last caller, that one thing you've got to bear in mind is the Congo is the exception in Africa, that in 1960, the year the Congo became independent, 16 or 17 other African countries also became independent. That you haven't heard anything about them at all for the simple reason they've been coming along quite well and starting to develop their economies and this sort of thing, kept out of the papers. It's only the, as here, it's only when something goes wrong that you read about situations like this.
So many Africans are doing a good job of governing themselves, then.
That's right, yes. And quite a good job, yes.
Is Russia still ruling the African nations, or have they kind of given them up?
Well, they still go through the motions, but... One suspects that their interest in the subject isn't as great as it was a few years ago. At the same time, the Chinese communists have gotten extremely interested in Africa and are very active today all over tropical Africa.
Of course, aren't there many Chinese, in Eastern Africa?
No, the Eastern Africa, Russ, was the Asian group there were the Indians and Pakistanis who settled in great numbers.
I see.
I have one other question, if I may, Mr. Gibbs.
Yes, Bernie, please do.
I want your personal evaluation of this, if you don't mind, sir. In your estimation, do you honestly feel that the missionaries have been of any great help to the Africans, especially, and this was covered, in view of the fact that there is a diversification of religious groups involved?
No, there's no question, Bernie, that they were on balance of considerable help. They brought education into the interior in places where schools had never existed.
Well, do these people want that and need it and use it?
Oh, yes, they want it very much, and they need it as much as anybody in the world needs it, and they are using it. I mean, if you're going to develop a country economically, you've got to have literacy to start with. You can't do it with a nation of illiterates, and so they need it. I mean, if any of these countries are going to be truly independent and self-sufficient, they must be literate.
Bernie, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk.
Good night, sir. Mr. Bernie Donovick, a gentleman from Denver, Colorado, who had several questions on the Congo and Africa. David, in one part of your book, I got quite a hoot out of reading. I guess it really wasn't funny, except that I think the way you put it down was so entertaining, about when they formed their air force, when the Simbas took over, and that they had watched the white man push through paperwork. And even though they didn't have the airplane, they still formed a beautiful air force on paper. Is this correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Did they do any other thing? In other words, they were practically worshiping the bureaucracy that they had witnessed under the Belgians. Is that it?
Yeah, that's about it. What they'd seen under the Belgians was no mean bureaucracy either.
It was a big one, then.
Right.
David, we have a caller standing by in Denver, Colorado, a listener on KTLN, Mrs. Blanche O'Neill. Good evening, Mrs. O'Neill. Speak right up. You're on Night Call.
Do we have to stay restricted to the topic of the Islamic book in Africa?
Yes.
I wanted to ask him how long it's written, and if he has to write it in research, and if he, is it a fiction or a non-fiction?
David?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
She wants to know a little bit about the actual book, the 111 Days in Stanleyville, whether or not, how long it took you to write it, whether or not you had help on it, and whether it's fiction or nonfiction.
It's nonfiction. It's straight reporting of the events that happened there. And it took about 6 months to do it, and I had the assistance of the research people of the Reader's Digest in gathering the information.
Is he connected with Reader's Digest?
That's right.
Yes, he's an editor, a roving editor.
Oh, a roving editor. I wanted to also ask him, does the Reader's Digest just accept nonfiction writing, or do they accept fiction, too, for freelancers?
Well, yeah, I mean, some of these book supplements are fiction, I suppose. Something. No, I guess they're not. No, it's with a rare exception, there's no fiction in it.
Blanche, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Thank you,
sir. Good night, ma'am. This is Blanche O'Neill, lady from Denver, Colorado, listening on KTLN. And let's go out to KTLN again. And we have a caller standing by, Mrs. Hansen. Good evening, Mrs. Hansen. Your comment, please.
Yes, first of all, I want to tell you how much I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
Very enlightening. You've learned many things.
Yes, ma'am.
And I just want to add a few words here, having had relatives in the consular service in Belgium, in the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say the fortunate they were to be, have had their services expire before the outbreak there. And we have received a number of lovely gifts from there, which are made by the students in the schools conducted by the Belgian government.
Now, were these made by Congolese students or by Belgian students?
No, by the Congolese. By the country. And these here schools were conducted by the Belgian government.
Well, now, David, didn't you just say that they really didn't give them much education?
No, higher education. There was lower education there. Primary education.
Mrs. Hansen?
Yes.
Do you feel that really this is a compliment, as it were, to the Belgian educational system, that the kids were only allowed or only able to make things to send out nice gifts? Don't you think there might have been more education here?
I really do. I think they have done a wonderful job there. Of course, now this is all could come on the spur of the moment. I possibly could have much more to say if I had this prepared. But from what we have learned from these relatives there, they have done wonderful work with the Congolese.
Well, do you think it's wonderful if they don't allow them to get higher education, or that they didn't?
Well, now that I could not say. I really could not say. I just make this comment here on the spur of the moment.
Right.
And from what they had to write from there, it all seemed to be that they were doing very good work.
Mm-hmm.
And what else should I say about it? Well, they had their artwork was wonderful. We have the beautiful pieces of leather work and the carvings of ivory. And that, I understand, was done by the students in these here colleges or schools if I put out by the Belgian government. And I think that's saying something. They endeavor to broaden their capacity of their learning.
Mrs. Hansen, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Yes.
And thank you for your comments.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Lady from Denver, Colorado, who believes that the Belgians were doing a good job, even though they didn't allow the Congolese to get higher education. Was that 40 college graduates in the whole country, David?
Less than 30.
We're talking tonight to Mr. David Reed, and he's the author of a book called 111 Days in Stanleyville, and that's put out by Harper & Row. If you'd like to read that book, I suggest you get it. It's on your bookshelves now, and I'm sure if it's not there, if you ask the shop owner, he'll be glad to get it for you. It reads well, it reads fast, and it's a rather informative book. David, how come the Simbas hated the Americans as they did?
The reasons for that were several, Russ. One reason was that the Americans had all along been identified, quite correctly, as the principal country behind the U.N. intervention. When I say quite correctly, we had supplied most of the money to, or half the money to keep the thing going, and we had flown troops in there in American planes from various member countries.
Up until that time, how was our reputation with the Congolese and the Zimbabwe?
We had none, in the sense that we were completely unknown to them.
I see.
We also, the Chinese communists have used the Americans as their whipping boys all along, and they have saturated the Congo, in particular the eastern Congo, where the Simba revolt erupted, with propaganda, both written propaganda and shortwave broadcasts, which can be picked up by transistor radios. There are radios all over the Congo, even in little villages. Thirdly, we had been supporting the government of Shombe, who came to power after a duel, the man whose name I couldn't remember for a moment. Militarily, we've been giving him military equipment, and we put airplanes at his disposal, transport planes, and later on, war planes. Never very many of them, a half a dozen perhaps at any one time, but they nevertheless, these war planes were very had a very devastating effect on the Simbas.
Our guest tonight is
Mr. David Reed, author, and our topic, the Congo. If you'd like to join us here, give us a buzz at area code 313-846-6601. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Good King Wenceslas looked out on the feast of Stephen.
Who was this King Wences?
Not Wences. Wenceslas.
Oh, I always thought it was good King Wenceslas looked out.
Oh, really?
Well, anyway, what was he looking at? The Feast of Stephen?
No, that was when he was looking. It was a religious festival, the Feast of Stephen.
So, what was he looking at then?
He was looking at a poor man gathering firewood.
So?
So, the king and his servant brought the man in, threw another log on the fire, and shared their meal with him.
Oh, I get the message. Christmas is a religious feast, and we're supposed to invite somebody to eat with us.
That's right. Especially somebody who might otherwise be alone at Christmas.
But just at Christmas? Hey, that's a bit phony, isn't it?
Well, you have to start sometime.
Like Winking Glass.
Wenceslas. Do you mind?
Would it matter?
No. Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb. Our guest tonight on Night Call, Mr. David Reed, author of 111 Days in Stanleyville, a book on the Congo and the Zimba Rebellion in the Congo back in 1964. If you have a question that you'd like to ask of Mr. Reed, or make a comment about the missionaries' role in the Congo or America's role in the Congo, give us a buzz at Night Call. It's very easy to do. Just dial area code 313-846-6601. Our lines are open, and we invite you to join us now on Night Call. Mr. Reed, we have a caller standing by in Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL, Mr. Gene Hagel. Good evening, sir. Speak right up. You're on Night Call.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Your comment, please.
I'm calling from Baltimore.
Yes, sir.
I had a question of your David Reed, is it?
That's correct.
What percentage, or of course you can't give an accurate percentage, of the number of people there actually even realize anything about the United States or Europe? Or the percentages of black and white, colonialism, and all these phrases. Are most of the people, the great majority, even conscious of that?
Well, they are to a degree, sir.
Well, now, some degree is a very good generality.
Well, the transistor radio has had a pretty devastating effect in Africa as elsewhere in the underdeveloped world. And whereas 10 years ago they would...
In other words, the increase in communication.
That's right. Whereas 10 years ago, they'd have no way of being in contact or aware of the outside world. Now they're very much so.
So until 10 years ago, would you say the great or vast majority of them were not even conscious of whether they were being run by Europeans, Belgians?
Well, they're aware of that. As the whole area was pretty well administered, there were very few tribes that escaped the attention of government.
I can hardly hear you. We must have a poor connection. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, real well, sir.
Speak up. Yes, go on.
David, go ahead.
I finished my point.
You said, I see. Let's see, whatever became, incidentally, of this character, Lumumba down there. I shouldn't say character because that's prejudicial. Is he still, he was presumably killed, is that correct?
That's right, he was murdered around 61 or 2. The winter of 61, 62, I think.
May I ask, Mr. Reed, were you a missionary in Africa?
No, I'm a journalist.
Or you, I only caught the program about 10 minutes ago, and I didn't understand whether you were a missionary or whether you were, and now you say you're a journalist.
Right.
I was over in Japan a few years ago, and I was speaking to a very elderly missionary who lived there most of his life, and he said that... something had confirmed what you had said a few minutes ago, that the actual impact numerically on the Japanese and the Orientals that he'd been in contact with was very, very proportionally very small. Is that your observation in the Congo also?
You mean the impact of missionaries?
Yes, the impact of actual Christianity and belief and so forth. You did say some very good things about the medical and educational impact, but so far as religion is concerned.
Well, the number of real Christians was and is a minority, but at the same time, however, the impact of Christianity has been quite considerable, really, in the sense that it was the missionaries, who brought education to the interior
for the first time. The impact has been in the field of education and sanitation, perhaps, and medical work.
That's right.
That was the impression I received in the Orient. I've never been down in Central Africa, and that's what I was interested to hear from you.
Now, well, there isn't much comparison between Japan and Africa, really. The Japanese have an old and well-established civilization of their own, and Christian missionaries aren't going to make half the dent in it as they would in a place like the Congo, which was just coming out of a very primitive existence, and where they were eager to accept anything from foreigners, so that the impact of Christian education in the Congo, for example, would be tremendous, whereas in Japan it would be fairly small.
Which has a civilization going back thousands of years.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Hagel, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
I certainly feel very fortunate in coming in.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Good night. Gentlemen from Baltimore, Maryland, questions on the Congo and on the late Patrice Lumumba. Actually, he was a hero to many of the Congolese, was he not?
That's right, Russ. And, his memory sort of still lives on in a, almost like, in the Eastern Congo, like a myth that he will come back in a sort of a second coming and right all wrongs.
In other words, sort of a resurrection.
That's right.
Why did he have this this divinity about him, as it were?
Well,
what was it? What did he do that made people think that he had the power to come back?
Well, Lumumba was a man of extraordinary talents as an orator, and he had what is fashionable these days to talk of as charisma, the ability to move masses of people. He was the most effective single politician the Congo has ever had.
In your book, you mentioned the fact that America and Americans got part of the blame for the murder of Lumumba.
Okay.
Why was this?
Well, this occurred in 61. He was arrested by the government in Leopoldville and sent in a plane to Katanga, which was then ruled by Shombe. And sometime later, Shombe's officials announced that Lumumba had been killed while attempting to escape from custody. No one who knew anything about the circumstance or the situation in the Congo believed this, of course, and it was soon apparent that he'd been murdered while in the custody of Shombe's police or soldiers.
David, let's go now to Manhattan, Kansas, a listener on WIBW, Mr. Earl Lamb. Good evening, Earl. Speak right up. You're on Night Call. Your comment, please, sir.
Well, I was just listening to your station about Congo.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you'd comment. The author would comment on the fact that the war was fought probably, as they, some people say, because of the minerals and, minerals deposit in the...
In the Congo?
Yes.
That would be in the Katanga province. Wasn't that where the big mining interests had their mines?
Yes.
I'm sorry, what was the question, Russ?
Well, Dave, he was wondering if you would comment about the reason for the war being actually mineral wealth. That this was controlled.
I don't think he mentioned anything about that at all. I don't think I heard.
Which war?
The rebellion, that part of the reason for the rebellion was that they wanted control, the Congolese wanted control of this rich area of the Congo.
Yes, I mean, which is right, there is right.
No, well, the area where the rebellion took place in Stanleyville is 1,000 miles or so from Katanga, the Katanga copper mines, which is, I think, what you have in mind.
But didn't the leader of the Zimbas want to take over all of the Congo?
Oh, yes, and that was his aim, ultimately, but the idea of getting the mines, I didn't figure very at all, as far as I could figure out in his program.
Earl?
The Congo government gets enormous royalties off these mines. It isn't a question of foreigners coming in there and digging out all their treasure and taking it away.
The Belgian government is not located, had no connection with the copper mines or whatever.
Well, I'm sorry, what was the question, sir?
He wants to know whether the Belgian government had any connection with the copper mines.
The ownership of the... Yeah, I think there is a... I'm not sure. The mines are principally owned by Belgians, and I'm not sure if the Belgian government is involved in any roundabout way in the way it's owned, but the big mines are principally Belgian-owned, that's right.
Earl, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Okay.
Thank you for your comments and questions.
Bye.
Gentlemen from Manhattan, Kansas, listening on WIBW in Topeka, Kansas. We have time for one more caller now, a gentleman in Pueblo, Colorado, a listener on KKAM, Mr. Bob Gilmore. Good evening, Bob. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, sir.
I wanted to ask you, Dave, about the kind of influence that the Christian missionaries have had in terms of what I assume is a kind of a national consciousness that the Congolese have had, which might have contributed to the revolution there. We hear very often that the Christian faith, in terms of its respect for the individual and its emphasis on certain concepts of freedom, have influenced several of these nations to which would be a greater contrast in the national consciousness of these people?
Well, I think either one of them is, figures into what little national consciousness does exist in the Congo. There's very little of it in any case.
Bob?
Yeah.
You have another comment.
You question whether there is any national consciousness at all.
That's right.
Yeah. And another thing I was wondering about in terms of the leadership, the question that was raised earlier, all from Baltimore, questioning whether they have the ability to lead. I wonder if you feel that in terms of the fact that there is ferment there, is there any way to let leadership develop except to let them lead their own country in whatever direction they take it?
Well, we were helping them with a lot of economic aid and so forth, and so are other countries. Ultimately, though, this is true anywhere in the world. An emerging country has got to solve its own problems. The foreigners can only do just so much.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you for calling Night Call. Just about used up our time tonight.
Okay.
Good night, sir. Thank you for calling. Mr. Bob Gilmore, a gentleman from Pueblo, Colorado, listening on KKAM. And Mr. David Reed, I want to thank you for being our guest on Night Call tonight. We've enjoyed having you. And your book, 111 Days in Stanleyville, is an excellent one. Good night, David.
Thank you, Russ. Good night.
Tomorrow night on Night Call, our guest will be Mr. Sanford Gottlieb of Sane. Mr. Gottlieb was the man who organized the recent Vietnam protest march on Washington. And we'll be talking to him about the Vietnam situation. Until then, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station. As a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life. Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.